Hi guys, welcome back to the Revive Stronger podcast. I'm your host, as always, Steve Hall, and this week I have John Tromlin on the podcast. He recently disrupted the industry with his protein research. The study was named No Upper Limit to the Anabolic Response to Protein Ingestion. And they essentially were looking into the question of, is there an upper limit to the amount of protein within a meal that's beneficial? Many of you will be aware of a 20 to 25 gram amount that is like the optimal amount to maximize muscle protein synthesis. Anything after that is all oxidized. But it might not necessarily be true. There isn't good evidence to suggest as a whole that that's absolutely correct. Some of that mechanistic research is not in line with the longitudinal research that we see with protein studies. So this study really delved into that question. It's very interesting to hear what led John to want to do this. And we dive into everything, the whole study, and then deeper into this in terms of practical recommendations. What total amount of protein do you want to eat? Does distribution matter? Protein quality? Also distribution across a week, for example. These are some of the things that you'll learn today about protein to maximize muscle growth. So definitely enjoy. And as always, guys, if you do enjoy these episodes, make sure to share it with anyone else you think might enjoy it. Subscribe to the podcast or to the YouTube. Give us a rating or a comment, a thumbs up. All of it goes a heck of a long way to help support the podcast and us to continue to get amazing guests, just like John, who I've been trying to get on for multiple years. So it's been amazing to have him on, and it's always highly appreciated. Even just a picture shared across onto your Instagram, on your stories, and tag me. That'd be amazing. So guys, without further ado, let's get into the chat. So John, you recently looked at the question of how much protein effectively can you use in a single meal. Your study took quite a lot of people by surprise. It kind of shook up what was commonly thought by a lot of maybe even the evidence-based space, people listening to this podcast. I think many are of on that opinion of, hey, if you eat over maybe 20 to 25 grams of protein, the rest is just purely wasted. And then maybe the evidence-based crowd would be like, hey, maybe actually it's not wasted, but you probably want to split your protein over maybe 3 to 6 meals, your total protein for the day. But even that has some problems, lacks full scientific validity. And there's some discordance between like acute MPS studies and longer term hypertrophic studies that have been looked at with protein over the long term. So I'd love to know initially why you wanted to kind of dive into this question a little bit, and then we can dive into kind of what you found.
Yeah, so let's start with that aspect of protein distribution that you mentioned. So the idea that it's better to split your protein intake up in various meals throughout the day rather than one or two big meals. And that is for like 90% based on acute studies where a certain amount of protein is given in a meal, and then the effect on anabolism is measured, usually muscle protein synthesis. And a variety of studies have been done, and very consistently, they all more or less came to the same conclusion that the first 20 grams of protein that you consume, very strong stimulation of muscle protein synthesis. If you increase it to 40 grams, you get a small increase, which I guess for this audience would be interesting, but in general, we already typically say like, it's not really necessary, 20 is optimal, and then above 40, basically no one thinks you needed that. So what happens when you start consuming those bigger doses anyway? Well, your body only has one way to get rid of it. If it's not built into tissues, you oxidize it, which basically you just burn it. And for protein, that's a waste. You want to use it as a building block. So that is where that principle of protein distribution was based on. But then as you mentioned, the longer term studies, they didn't really find a difference between studies distributing in whatever type of pattern, whether it was 3 versus 6 meals, or even more extreme, the intermittent fasting or the time-restricted feeding studies, in which people consumed all their food, so also all their protein in a small window during the day, usually 18 hours, and then you're fasted for 16 hours. From a protein distribution point of view, that should be horrible. But even in those extreme variations, that suboptimal protein distribution, you didn't really see a decrease in lean body mass, for example. So when the acute and the long-term studies seem to be contrasting, what a lot of people do is they just pick one of the two because they like or understand it better. And then they say, like, you should believe this one. No, the proper response should be like, okay, something isn't adding up. Let's try to investigate why not. So for example, it could simply be, this is what I thought for a long time, is the long-term studies, they're really not that long-term usually. They usually have only a relatively small amount of subjects, because who wants to participate in a study where they say, you either have to eat like this or like this, and you have to do it for 6 months, right? So the studies are not that big, not that long. So I, for a long time, thought, once we've done a lot of these studies, we can combine them in a meta-analysis, and then you'll get a clear picture. But as more and more research came out, I started becoming more and more skeptical. So I was like, maybe there's something with the acute studies that's not, why it's not translating. So then I got a little bit of inspiration from snakes. Obviously not humans, but snakes can eat like 25% of their body weight, which is, for guys like us, like 20 kilograms of steak. Well, I'm sure you like steaks, but good luck eating 20 kilograms of steaks. And then, of course, snakes are not humans. But I was wondering, could the same... Well, let me explain. So snakes eat these huge meals, and then you can see that they are digesting the meals for days, and protein synthesis is elevated for days. So very different than what we thought happens in humans, just an elevation for a couple of hours. So I was wondering, could this also happen in humans? Maybe not as extreme, but the same principle. And there I got a little bit of inspiration, basically from barbecues. I once woke up in the middle of the night, had to pee. I was kind of like, I just felt that I still had a lot of meat in my gut, basically. And I was like, whoa, I finished eating like 8 hours, maybe 10 hours ago, and I just feel I haven't fully digested this meal. So then I came back to those acute studies, and all of them, they were up to 6 hours long. Like, we've done one of them, we came kind of to the same conclusion. We did the longest one with 6 hours, and we didn't really see much of a benefit of doses above 20 grams. But there, from my own experience, I noticed, like, with these large amounts of protein, if they're still digesting 8 hours later, by definition, that protein has not even reached the muscle. So maybe there is a benefit. You just don't see it in the first couple of hours after measuring it in these acute studies. So that's where the big idea came from. We'll do, again, one of those dose response studies very acutely. But now we give the larger dose of protein a lot more time to digest and finally be incorporated into muscle tissue. And all of a sudden, then you get a very different conclusion.
Yeah, I think the snake idea is, I mean, I can picture it, literally that snake that's like got this huge animal inside of it is just like sitting there digesting. But it's like you said, like when you just think about what happens through digestion, it makes sense that that protein could still be useful. And it's so interesting to think that you can come to conclusions, but it's based off how the research has been done. It's like, well, we actually just haven't looked into this other area to give us better explanations behind other things. And I guess, at least when I think about it too, from like a evolutionary perspective, when we were like hunter-gatherers, obviously we would like feast and like have famine probably when we had like hadn't found animals to eat or what have you. So it kind of goes against the body trying to survive if we're going to see that something like this is wasted once we eat a large amount of it. So yeah, I think it's very interesting. I'm glad you investigated it. So I'd love to hear what you guys did to look into this question and kind of then what you found.
Yeah, so the basic principle was pretty simple. We tested three different amounts of protein. One group got nothing, just to see what happens if you have simply no building blocks available. Then one group got 25 grams of protein. We selected 25 because it's a little bit that upper limit, what people often consider optimal, with very minimal, if any, benefits by going higher. And then 100 grams. Why 100 grams? Again, barbecue. We did a small little pilot in our research group, and we just looked how much protein can we eat before we have to start force feeding ourselves. And we got to about 100 grams of protein. You can easily eat a lot more than that if you want to, but you would do it because you want to eat a lot. So it's, if you're like a healthy guy, a little bit of a bro, like, ooh, protein, you can relatively easily get 100. More than that, most people will start struggling. So it was just the practical upper limit in a sense, because we really considered it just as a proof of principle. See what with the highest feasible dose you can give. Let's see what happens there. It was not to investigate whether 100 grams is the optimal dose. It's just to see this concept of 25. Is that all you can use? Is that correct? Yes or no? And so the other treatment, 100 grams, just go as high as possible. So that's the three doses we tested. Then subjects did exercise in the morning, whole body exercise, relatively simple whole body workout that anyone who does some work, whole body workout would do. And then we measured muscle protein synthesis for 12 hours, which is 2 to 3 times longer than those previous studies. So we measured it over the first 4 hours because you need 2 biopsies to measure muscle protein synthesis over a certain time frame. You can't track it minute by minute. So we picked the first 4 hours because that's how a lot of those earlier studies had done it. We simply wanted to compare. We did 8 hours because that's often how long people sleep. So that's the longest periods where people usually don't eat. So we want to see how much protein would you need for that, or at least could you digest for that long? And then 12, which was basically the longest we could do until people would have to go to bed again. So the day would be over. And then we did 101 fancy things, so to speak. In order to measure as many aspects from metabolism, you have to use what's called stable isotopes, in this case, amino acid tracers, who are just amino acids with an innocent chemical flag. So you can follow the amino acids through the body, and then you can measure exactly what happens with digestion and absorption, how much of the ingested protein appears in the circulation, like literally the percentage, the speed at which it's digested, how much ends up in muscle tissue, how much the whole body, so not just the muscle, uses. A lot of nerdy details, but the basic concept is just how much protein, how long are you digesting it, and how long and how much is anabolism turned on. And of course, the final component is the protein burned? Is it wasted or not? So amino acid oxidation.
Yeah, and I think from reading, it was also a milk-based protein, right? You didn't use a whey protein like some of the researchers use a milk-based protein. Did you have a particular reason for choosing that? And do you think that has any caveats that people should be aware of?
Yeah, so we used milk protein for a couple of reasons. One is we used what's called intrinsically labeled protein, which just means it has that fancy amino acid tracers, those chemical flags built into the protein, so that instead of getting 1 or 2 outcomes in our study, we had like 50. You just need more fancy properties. But very important for people to know that intrinsically labeled protein doesn't change anything about the physiological properties of the protein. So it's just milk protein anyone would be able to get for €1. For us, it's a little bit more expensive, but it's just so you can measure additional things. Now, why milk protein? Well, one of the reasons is because it has the biggest contribution to protein intake in the Western world. Because when you do a study, everyone is always going to say, why this protein? Why not that one? So we just picked the one that has the largest contribution to protein intake so that we can say, hey, it's as ecologically valid as possible because it's most reflective of what people normally eat. That milk protein is also a fairly slowly digestible protein. In a study like this, you often want to use protein in isolation. If you use whole foods, often it's not just protein, and then you get, is the 100 grams of beef probably also has more fat. So then calories get into the mix and becomes very complicated. With whole foods, is also how much do you chew on your protein impacts protein digestion. So to make it as isolated as possible, you want to use a protein powder. By using a relatively slow digesting protein, it's still very clean, but because it's slowly digesting, it more reflects what would happen with a meal. So whey protein is a very high quality protein, but it's very rapidly digesting. And that probably doesn't reflect how most people would eat. So we just picked a very high quality protein that would be the best estimate of what would happen with an actual meal.
Yeah, I think that makes
sense. Maybe to quickly add on your question, do I think there would be differences with different protein sources? Not much. So on one hand, you have just the concept of protein quality in general. So let's say you have a plant-based protein, then maybe the 100 grams of plant-based protein, maybe it would give 80% of the effect of the high-quality milk-based protein, but 80% of 100 grams milk protein is an insane large effect. So the basic concepts of the study that you can use all the protein and that it, the more you give, the longer it digests, that would be absolutely true. Whether the actual muscle protein synthesis rates might be slightly higher, slightly lower, sure, but who cares? Then the same question for whey protein, because that's of course often supplemented in the fitness world. They're kind of, my guess is because both whey and milk protein are very high quality proteins. They have everything and all the properties you want in protein. I would expect that with whey protein in the first 4 hours, you would have a slightly higher muscle protein synthesis just because it's more rapidly digestible. So more availability, and maybe instead of the milk protein, which was still digesting at the end of 12 hours, maybe the whey would have been fully digested and absorbed after 10 hours. I don't know. But again, the basic principle is, well, if you want your whey to last longer, then take 120 grams of whey protein or 130. Because with an isolated protein power, you're not really limited to that 100 grams even. So the main concept, if you take more anabolism and it will last longer, I'm very convinced that's universal for any protein. The exact timeline and the exact anabolic response might vary a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's really well explained. That is a question I had, and I think probably a few people had, and maybe they were suspect that the protein would have a huge influence. But the principle, like you said there, just applies probably across the board. Obviously, hard to say definitely because you haven't done the studies, but it would make sense that it would. So that's great. I guess now everyone's interested in, what did you find? Did you find like this upper limit, this threshold that we should try and avoid kind of just having more protein for the sake of it going over, or did we find something else?
Yeah, so the short version is the 100 grams of protein blew the 25 grams of protein out of the water. The most interesting thing there is that in the first 4 hours, the 100 grams resulted in 20% higher muscle protein synthesis compared to the 25 grams, which is kind of in range what we see with other dose response studies that measure pretty short. Usually you see between 10 and 20%, and you know, we're at that upper range, 20% higher in the initial time frame. But then when we measured longer over the entire 12 hours, the difference between the 100 grams and the 25 grams was that the 100 grams was 30% higher, which shows that the majority of the benefit is in the later phase. Simply, the way I see it is the 25 grams just runs out of steam pretty early. It's just out of gas. And then the 100 grams of protein just keeps going much longer. So I think if we would have measured an additional hour, because the 100 grams was still digesting at the end of the 12 hours, I think the difference in percentage would have been even bigger, because every additional hour, the 25 grams would have zero added benefit. It was gone while the 100 grams was still working. So that was on muscle protein synthesis, which is the one you're, well, I would say both scientifically as well as practically, it's the one that's most interesting. The reason is when we measure muscle protein synthesis, there's very little assumptions in the method. It's literally you take biopsy, a couple hours later, you take a second biopsy, you see how much of those amino acids with the chemical flag have been built into the muscle, and it's going to be more or it's not going to be more. There's no assumptions in the method. You just see what you get, basically. Then the other aspect is that obviously muscle tissue is what athletes are most interested in. So often some other researchers in their papers, they always say like, oh, we measured whole body protein anabolism, and because there's more than muscle, and that sounds very good if you're not an expert in the methodology, but there's two problems with that. Number one is that is a very indirect measurement. So I just mentioned with muscle, you can biopsy it. I cannot biopsy your brain, your heart, your lungs. So it's an indirect measurement. It is basically, let's just call it an estimation. And then an additional problem is there's like 20 ways to do it. Most of it, not that good. So when you see these outcomes about whole body protein metabolism, they're not as convincing just from methodology aspect, but also even if whole body metabolism goes up more with a higher amount of protein, what does that mean? If it's not the muscle, then where does the protein go? Do you get a thicker skin? Is that good? Do you get thicker bowels? Is that good? Or is that like a GH gut? It's like people do like the wishful thinking like, oh yeah, more anabolism, it must be good. But I'm not convinced that if it doesn't end up in the muscle, that it's necessarily a good thing. So yeah, we measured tons of aspects of protein metabolism, but by far the most important one is the protein, the muscle protein synthesis. And there you just clearly saw more protein, bigger effect.
Yeah. So I think that's the thing that kind of probably shocked quite a lot of people, where they were maybe expecting to see a cap. They weren't just expecting to see this dose response effect. But I guess you went into this study thinking, looking at these snakes and thinking about that a bit more, this was kind of the outcome you were expecting to see. Is that fair?
I was hoping, I was optimistic that it would be the case. Like, I was pretty convinced that the protein would be digesting for a lot longer. I for various reasons, I was pretty convinced of that. But then the big question is, would the muscle still be sensitive to use all that protein? Or maybe at some point there's just a signal where it says, oh, we've had enough anabolism for the day. We're done working. It's 5 o'clock. Let's go home. Because there has been some suggestion on that in the literature. It's called the muscle full effect. So I wasn't convinced we would see it on the muscle, but had to guess, my guess was 75% that yes, we would find this. Because again, that was the only possible explanation I could come up with on how to unite the acute studies with the long studies. And again, I hate it when people say, oh, this study must be wrong, or this type of research, there must be something we're missing. And this was like the one thing I could think of, oh, with this result, all of a sudden everything fits in again. But it's still kind of scary, because we also did like those dose response studies, the shorter versions. And we also came to the, oh, all you need is 20 grams of protein. But again, we didn't measure as long. So I was optimistic, but still scary, especially if you do a big, very expensive study. It's like, could have done 5 other studies for this money. It's better work.
Did this, having done this, does it lead you to further questions that you're wanting to investigate? Or did this kind of give you the kind of proof of principle?
Well, I have infinite questions that I want to investigate, to be honest. We joke now at the lab that we're done, in the sense that we are now, especially me, of the opinion that as long as you eat a lot of protein, everything else are details in the protein side of, let's call it, fitness. Because what this study kind of suggests, as long as you eat a lot of protein, kind of by definition, you cover protein distribution. Because whether you provide amino acid availability the whole day because you eat at regular intervals, or because you eat one huge bolus but you're digesting it for 16 hours, the end result is the same. Both cover distribution. Distribution is the wrong word. Both cover 24/7 building block availability. So yeah, protein distribution, not that interesting. Now we get back to the topic of protein quality. What is the purpose of protein? It kind of has two, it serves two roles. It provides building blocks, and we can go in a little bit more detail. You need all the different essential amino acids in, well, I wouldn't say a specific ratio, but you need all of them. So very, very quickly, the way I always explain it, if you want to build a house, you need bricks, you need doors, and you need windows. And if you have a million bricks and a million doors, but you have no windows, you cannot really build a functional house. It's the same with protein synthesis in the body. You need all the essential amino acids. And if you don't have one, you can't really use the other ones either. So with protein quality, what we often talk about, plant proteins, they have lower quality because they miss one of the essential amino acids. Simple solution, eat more. Sometimes you see that a protein source has a little bit lower digestibility. Eat more. So eating more solves all possible issues. I'm not saying that's always the most practical solution, but especially for the fitness crowd who's not gutting, just eat a lot of protein and you got that aspect covered. Of course, when you are cutting, for example, and you don't have unlimited calories, you have to start making more. You have to calculate the ROI almost on what you eat. Maybe there are changes. But if you're just an average guy who wants to make good gains, you can sweat about all the details, but probably eating 20 grams more protein, what you do now, is a lot better than how you distribute it, which type of protein you take. It just solves everything. That was a long rant, so I don't want to continue with what other questions do you have? I have millions if you want to know, but I'll leave that up to you.
That's great. And yeah, definitely confirmed what we already knew, like total protein intake at the end of the day is always trumping how you spread that through the day. But I think some people maybe took those acute MPS studies too far and they're like, oh, I'm just going to have 20 grams and then 20 grams. And maybe they'd undershoot their total protein amount and kind of get it wrong and miss the forest for the trees in that sense. So this definitely helped move people towards that total protein intake. And I guess, I don't know if some people are thinking, it's just a question that's come into my head of obviously you got higher MPS and MPS lasted longer. I'm assuming there is eventually a cap, like, okay, so a gram per pound is generally like the golden rule what people talk about in terms of protein intake, may even be higher than you need. But if you were to eat more than that, you're not going to see even more MPS. Like, it's not a case of the dose response is just infinite where more protein is better, like the old school bodybuilders would do.
Yeah, so that's like the title is easy to misunderstand what I'm saying, for example. So if you read the actual paper, I know, strange concept, why would anyone ever do that? But if you read the paper, nowhere in the paper do I say, oh, people should eat this much in a meal or in a day. The title simply reflects, if you theoretically would eat 200 grams, I think you will use almost everything, a little bit gets oxidized, but almost everything will ultimately be effectively used. It might just take 2 days, right? So that's why when I say there is no limit, it's, if you can get it in your stomach, it will eventually be used probably, but it will take a long time. Then an interesting question is, what would happen if you would, for example, directly infuse amino acids in the body? So bypassing that limitation there, I think, yeah, ultimately you will reach maximal muscle protein synthesis and you would just maintain it for forever at the maximal rate. Because when you if I get back to that, the 100 grams was about 20% higher than the 25 grams. That kind of is in line with the earlier studies where the 40 grams were also 20% higher in that early time frame. So that might suggest that that rate we had with 100 grams, you cannot go higher. That's uncertain because maybe with a fast digesting protein, you would go higher. But I could see there is some maximal muscle protein synthesis rate. I just think in practice, like you would never run into it in practice because you would need to do something weird, like consuming, I don't know, 150 grams of whey protein in a single meal or have an amino acid infusion. When you eat normal food, something that's relatively slowly digesting, you are going to use it all. It just takes a long time. Then the other thing is, like everyone kind of know or should know, is you can eat all the protein in the world You're not going to become Ronnie Coleman by just eating protein. So, for example, in this study, this was after exercise. So one question I still have is, what would happen in people with no exercise? Like, I can imagine that after challenging exercise, your body is like, okay, we better use every building block we got. That's our number one challenge for survival. What if you don't do any exercise at all? Then your body might think, well, I can build all this lean mass, but that will just cost calories and burn more calories. Like, what? It's not benefiting me in any way, if anything. So I'm not convinced you would see the same effect without exercise, for example. But yeah, let me make clear, the title does not mean that I think the more protein you eat, you'll gain more. It simply means you're not wasting the protein that you eat. But it's not necessarily beneficial if you have 200 grams of protein in your stomach and then you don't have to eat 2 days. Like, there's no benefit other than at some point you'll use it.
This is really interesting because I, practically as a coach, this is something that I have done with clients where I'll have like, maybe I'll give them macro targets and I'll be like, hey, if you meet your fat and carbohydrate on average for the week, I'm pretty happy. Like, I don't worry if there's a bit of variation. You can store glucose as glycogen. You can have like, you have stores of fat, but protein, this is something you want to meet every day because we have no way of storing this apart from in your muscles and areas we don't want to utilize it from. But from what you explained there, it may be actually even more flexible where if you want to go 200 grams one day and then 150 another day, and on average, you kind of meet your weekly total, you could apply that same kind of flexibility potentially. Is that right?
Yeah, potentially. So I think as long as it's still in your stomach, like your stomach is kind of like a timing or how do you call it? A slow release reservoir almost. So, another reason why I thought of this study, before I did a lot of work on pre-sleep protein, and then people always ask, does it still matter if you eat earlier in the day? And I said, well, depends on what you eat earlier in the day. If you just eat a normal diet, then yes, I don't think that protein will last you throughout the whole night. So most people have dinner, let's say at 6. I don't think that will last you the next 12 hours if you wake up at 6 o'clock, which is early for a lot of people. But then I had this idea for a long time. I always said, well, if you eat a barbecue in the evening, I don't see much benefit of pre-sleep protein. So I definitely think what you ate yesterday can carry in the next day, but there's a limit. And again, it's like a practical limit, what fits in your stomach. Now, there's also a little bit of, this is very speculative, but there's a little bit of a theory in protein metabolism that a lot of, like most of the protein that you consume does not end up in muscle tissue. So for example, in this study, we saw that with 100 grams, about 13 grams from the top of my head ended up in muscle tissue. Now, I already said, the majority, almost nothing of the protein got burned, wasted. So where does all the other protein go? It goes in other organs. And so one of the theories is that those other organs, almost all other organs have a faster turnover. What means is they're renewing themselves faster than muscle. So they would be the first one to release amino acids once you're out of protein. So there's a little bit this theory that as soon as you run out of protein, the other organs can give the amino acids, for example, to muscle tissue. So that might also be a little bit of a carryover effect, but that is very speculative still.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think that's interesting. And yeah, it's just opening up the doors for a little bit more flexibility, which I think is generally a good thing. Although, again, it's going to make a few of the bros eating 6 meals a day and specifically kind of worrying about all of that a little bit upset. But I think the same can be said for when I first came across like flexible dieting. It's like, oh, I don't have to eat like muscle building foods. It's every food can be muscle building. It's kind of the macros, and obviously micronutrition matters too. It just allows more people to kind of enjoy the process, and probably why so many people see great results with different methods too.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is when I did the pre-sleep studies, where the basic idea was most people have breakfast Yes. Most people have protein at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So during those 12 hours of the day, they have amino acid availability. But then there's like, depending on how long you would digest your dinner, there's like easily for like 8-6 hours of during the night, there's no amino acid availability. So the whole idea from the pre-sleep protein was, well, one, you're consuming more. Good habit anyway. But it's also, if you're going to take extra protein, you might as well take it before sleep, because then one, you have more, and it's also at the best moment to improve your distribution. So when I did that research, everyone said like, no, the distribution definitely doesn't work. Look at the long-term studies. And I was like, well, it's not like the long-term studies are necessarily correct, blah, 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 blah. And now this study comes out, and now the other side attacks me like, no, this cannot prove this, because it's just like, I have no bias either way. I just want to know how things work. I cannot understand why anyone would be mad about this, because if you want to stick to protein distribution, you're definitely not worse off. There is no mechanism I can think of why protein distribution in practice would, why you would be worse off, other than it's a hassle. But if it's not a hassle for you, like, do it for your physiology. If you're someone who thinks like, that's so annoying, or I like intermittent fasting, this is just great news, because it suggests that you're probably not worse off, or if anything, there's a minimal difference. So there's only potential upside about this, unless someone wants to feel really good, like, I'm out grinding the position everyone else because I wake up in the middle of the night. Other than that, you should be happy about things.
Do you not see the progress you would like? Are you sick of writing your own programs? Or perhaps you need some accountability in order to stick with a plan? Then it's time to start working with us. We at Revive Stronger offer a truly personalized coaching service. You'll get more than just an email with some macros or random cookie cutter program. With Revive Stronger, you will be the center of our attention. You will receive your own fully individualized training protocol alongside a customized nutritional strategy. We create the coaching around your needs, wants, personal preferences, and your own unique lifestyle. Every single week, we delve into your program in order to make appropriate adjustments so that we get the most out of your time and the best possible outcome. We help both female and male athletes to seriously change their body composition by adding more muscle mass and decreasing fat tissue. No matter if you're a competitive bodybuilder or just want to look better, if you need help with your progress and taking your physique to the next level, our coaching is for you. It's time to make a change. Sign up today and let's revive stronger.
I have done that. I think once I couldn't finish a meal and I left it by my bedside. I was like, yeah, I'll eat that in the night because that just makes sense. And man, yeah, not fun times. So if I'm to push you here, Jean, it seems that the evidence doesn't really support protein distribution particularly. Do you, though, for the person who's very serious, who wants to maximize everything, do you still have like a lower limit or a protein distribution you would recommend for that person?
Well, in practice, recommend is a big word, but I like, unless you have some natural affinity to, say, time-restricted feeding, why not try to have a decent protein distribution? Like, if anything, it makes your life easier, because most people, which for a lot of, let's say, bodybuilders would be their partner or their family, have a 3 meals a day routine already. Well, you add maybe a little bit of a bigger doses prior to sleep, because that one needs to last you over a relatively long period. Then you already have 4 doses over the day. You're good. So if you're worried about details, protein distribution is so easy. So why not do it? If you're a competing athlete with minimal effort, you can have 4 meals throughout the day pretty easily. Why not do it? Now, if you're someone, you have some people who are like, in the morning, I cannot eat, I don't want to eat, this is a bit of a relief, don't worry about it, then don't eat in the morning. Or, you know, it's relief for people who don't want to do it. But honestly, protein distribution, if that's difficult for you to have like at least 4 decent-sized meals, I worry about your coach, how you're sticking to training and everything else. Like, protein distribution is not that hard. And with minimal effort, you already have 4 meals a night. If there's a small benefit, then I think 4 meals throughout the day will cover 99% of it. And I don't see going to 5 or 6 will have any meaningful difference.
Cool. Yeah, I think that aligns with, it was like a Yasuda et al. 2020, if you're aware of that one, where it's like 12 weeks that a high protein breakfast and even versus even distribution, sorry, high protein breakfast with even distribution versus a low protein and uneven distribution of protein. So it was like three doses of good quality protein versus two. And there was like a non-significant difference where three beat two. And I think Taguchi, if I'm saying that one right, et al. 2021, the researchers compared the effects of higher six versus three, and they saw basically no difference six versus three. So it seems like at least some of these studies where there's not a lot actually, that are looking maybe three is like this minimum. If you really want to maximize things, going to two, it's a non-significant difference. One might be slightly worse than that. And like, that's pretty impractical anyway. If you're eating a lot of protein, like 1 gram per pound in one sitting, you're not doing that through a barbecue probably. It's maybe you can do it over two barbecues. Like you said, I think that opens quite a lot up. Something I did want to, sorry, go on.
Yeah. So what I just very quickly wanted to say is like, especially if you're worried about protein distribution, not necessarily the amount, take a protein shake. Take one before bed, take one after training. Now you have three meals plus two extra meal moments. Like protein distribution, like I like this stuff. I like thinking about every minor thing, of course. You as a coach will have the same. But one, I think it will make minimal, if any, difference. Two, it's so easy. Just take a random protein shake at a moment, boom. You improve your distribution. So yeah, I think it's a non-issue. And if you think it's an issue, very easy. Take a protein shake, boom, on to the next goal.
Yeah, I think it definitely is an easy task. And something I did want to touch on, you mentioned this kind of pre-bed feeding and maybe making that larger. Am I right into reading into that? If, say, your goal was 200 grams by the end of the day, if you did 50, 50, 100, would that be better than doing 100, 50, 50 in your book? Or does that actually make a difference?
So at 200 grams a day will for pretty much everyone be so much that I think distribution is a non-issue. So that comes back to that basic principle. If your protein intake is high, distribution, I just don't see it mattering. Like you're going to have amino acids the whole day. So the basic advice that I now recommend based on this is just, how much should you consume in a meal? Well, it depends on when your next meal is. If your next meal is in 4 or maybe 5 hours, that 20 gram is a pretty good target for most people. If you're a serious athlete looking for, you know, the small little gains, make it 40. But if your meal is like 6 hours or longer away, you just want to increase your amount of protein. So it's basically, you just dose dependent on how long it needs to last you, just as you would fuel your car with more fuel if you need to go further. So I don't really like a specific target like this much at that moment. Like with sleep, it entirely depends. I know people who sleep barely 6 hours. They don't need a big pre-sleep dose. If you're going to sleep in on the weekend, you might need a little bit more. So rather than thinking of it as a set target, which people hate because people love, like, this is a number, I don't have to think about it. But the basic concept is still very simple. The longer your next meal is away, the more protein you need in this meal.
Cool. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I was just wondering if there was like anything too, if you have that large meal and then one quite soon after, if it just kind of like adds on top and the digestion just gets pushed back. So in the end, it kind of didn't matter where you took it.
Yeah, that's what I think, but we don't have good data on that. But if you look at, so I mentioned that when muscle protein synthesis, you can only measure that between biopsies. So usually that's over a period of several hours. If you look at the muscle protein synthesis rates in this study, you do see that the first 4 hours, they are the highest when your plasma amino acid concentration from your protein is also the highest. Then the next 4 hours, it is a little bit lower. The next 4 hours, it is a little bit lower, which suggests if you would have additional food that would be ideally rapidly digested, that would, like, you could do a top up. There's room potentially for a top up, but that is speculative. Yeah.
I think to me, that makes sense as well. But like you said, it's speculative, and at the moment, like getting, you know, it essentially comes back to your breakfast, lunch, dinner. It's not super difficult for people to do, and that essentially looks like it'll probably maximize everything for you as long as you're eating enough.
Yeah, but also, like as much as I love protein, people greatly overestimate the impact of protein. So when you just look at studies, this comes back to our discussion about the long-term studies. If you just look at studies where one group gets more protein than the other group, the majority of studies like that, even in people who train, the majority finds no benefit of protein. Now, that's not because protein doesn't work or because they already eat enough or whatever. It's simply because there is an effect, but it's pretty small. So you need a lot of data before you get a clear picture. So until we had the first meta-analysis that our lab did, it wasn't that clear that protein actually worked in these long-term studies. You need a lot of data. But that alone shows, like, even slightly different distribution, or you have 1.6 versus 1.8 or 2.0, whatever, that is going to make such a minimal difference. So yeah, I wish I could say, like, for every 10 grams you consume extra, you'll gain 10 grams a week extra. But the incremental effect of more protein is very, very small. So don't worry about it too much. If you worry about it, eat a little bit more and all the details will take care of themselves.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And your study in with, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on it, Wilkinson et al., the 2023 meta-analysis that looked at leucine. Mm-hmm. And like the take home seemed to be, leucine may not be as important as we previously thought, where you had to meet this threshold to maximize MPS, so long as you're eating enough high quality protein through the day. Was that your take home with your study included with this one? Did that change any recommendations for you?
Well, I was never a big fan of, like, some people really made everything about leucine. So just a little bit of background, leucine is one of the essential amino acids, and it's the one that's most potent at stimulating mTOR, which is basically a signal in the body of anabolism. mTOR kind of seems to be a signal that needs to be on before your body starts to do anything. I just see it as a traffic light. It needs to turn green. I don't know how the lights work in the UK, but they need it to start in green. And then you start, everything starts happening. But yes, that signal function is important, but this comes back to the discussion about essential amino acids. You need all the essential amino acids, otherwise you cannot build. So if leucine is the signal that says, okay, we need to start building houses, the other amino acids are the bricks, the doors, the windows. If you don't have them, maybe you can build a little bit of some scratch that's lying around, but you're not going to build houses until you get everything else. So yes, it seems like if you want to optimize anabolism, you want to have leucine around. But if you just eat protein, you're going to have leucine and everything else. Like, there's no good reason to look at it in isolation anyway. So you saw for a time that there was a little bit of like protein recommendations were like, eat enough protein to hit 2 grams of leucine in a meal. And it's not like, the concept is not necessarily bad. But it's more because, generally speaking, if a protein is higher in leucine, then it's also higher in most other essential amino acids. So it's more like a marker of the essential amino acid content than leucine on its own. So there's nothing wrong with leucine. It's a very important amino acid, but I don't count my leucine in my diet. If you, again, it comes back to the same concept. If you consume enough protein, you're consuming enough leucine anyway.
Yeah, I think that's really nicely and well said. And I don't know if you're comfortable summarizing for you the kind of, if someone is trying to maximize muscle growth when it comes to protein, what would their objective be?
Yeah, so the number you hear most is 1.6 gram per kilogram per day. based on a meta-analysis where they just looked at what point does additional protein supplementation not clearly show an additional benefit. And they kind of came to the conclusion based on what's called a breakpoint analysis that it was 1.6. Now, for the people who are familiar with that paper, if you look at that graph, it's the most ugly graph I've ever seen. It's like we have all these data points, and we have to pick a point that seems where everything plateaus, but by no means is it like, oh, beautiful, all the points are on a line. Yes, this is clearly the breakpoint. So what I take away from that, that's a nice guess where we should start thinking about it. I see it more as that's a good number for future studies, like start testing whether it is 1 point. So I see it more as a instruction for future research rather than the conclusion that that's the optimal number. In addition, in studies like that, the protein intake is always based on self-reports. So it's people who participate in a study, they have a food diary for a couple of days, and then it seems like, oh, they ate 1.3 grams per kilogram per day habitually. And then the study usually is, let's give them 50 grams of protein per day extra, two supplements of 25 grams at two different time points. The problem is that protein intake is almost always, well, almost all food is underreported. So we did a study in elite Dutch athletes where you would think they are serious about their nutrition and stuff like that. They underreported protein by 25%, which is to me still amazing. But that just makes me think that that number from that meta-analysis is probably also underreported. Now, having said that, this comes back to what we discussed earlier. All these long-term studies, they're not that long. They're not that good at convincing. So there's not like I have anything better to base it on. So I go with the flow in that sense that probably that 1.6 gram as a serious athlete is the minimum you should aim for. I think it might be a lot higher, partly because of the underreporting, partly because the data is not that clear. Do we have a clear number? No. But if you're serious, I would at least aim for that 1.6, maybe for the 2.0, if it's not like a headache for you. Like, depends on which sport you're in. A lot of fitness people, they have no issue. Like, if I would tell them eat 3 grams a day, you're like, sure. So if protein is not a hassle, I would go to 2 grams. That's just accounting for that 25% underreporting. If it fits in the macros, for example, it fits in the preferences of the athlete, I would say that's a number. Once you're there, I just don't see, even if their higher numbers have an additional benefit, honestly, above 1.5 even, I would say at their protein is not really going to be a limiting factor. Yes, you might gain a little bit more, recover a little bit better, but the incremental effect of protein is just going to diminish anyway. So yes, I like the thought assignment of what's the optimal protein intake. I think once you have 1.5 grams, you're solid. Like, that's not going to be your problem. That doesn't mean that in practice, if you're serious, why not aim for 2 grams? How much additional benefit you're going to see from that or even higher is probably minimal.
With that, just to confirm, is that per kilogram of lean mass or is that just total?
Yeah, the lean mass I'm not a big fan of because most people, including serious athletes, just as they cannot, is maybe not the right word, but okay, they cannot adequately report their protein intake. Everyone, their lean mass is like 80% wishful thinking.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm sure you have it with your clients when you ask them what their body fat percentage is and you see their photos, you're like,
yeah.
How do I say this without insulting them, right? So I'm just the concept of basing it on lean body mass makes a lot of sense unless you start working with people and start realizing their guess for lean body mass and just most machines that people have access to are pretty horrible as well, like the BIOS and stuff like that. So
yeah,
it's just easier to base it on body weight. Most research has based it on body weight. So there's just, the concept makes sense, but it introduces new assumptions that balance it out.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. The only time I really change anything is if I've got someone who's like quite obviously obese. It's like, okay, this is going to be wildly too much for you if you're in like very like overfat scenario. But in most cases, most people listening to this are probably lean enough where it's pretty close anyway.
That actually brings up an interesting point. So it's not that clear. Like, just logically, I would really expect this to be the case. It's just not that clear from research that bigger people need more protein. It's just not clear if someone would be twice my size, they literally like that it's just a linear increase. Not that much research has looked into it, but the research that has looked into it, it's not that clear that they need more. Now, again, I would play it safe. If you're bigger, why not eat more? Makes a lot of sense. But I think the main lesson there is if you're smaller, it's not clear you actually need less. So if you're a bigger dude than in the average study, let's say that 1.6 gram is based often on, you know, college kids, often even college kids that train, so they have a little bit of size. But if you're a competing bodybuilder, you might have more lean body mass. Why not play it safe, eat a little bit more? But if you're a small gymnastics girl, I wouldn't say like, ooh, I'm half their size, I'm going to eat half the protein. Because again, it's not clear that it's a linear relationship. So I would, for lighter people, maybe you need a little bit more per kilogram just to play it safe. For the bigger people, it's not clear you need that much more than normal people, but you might as well, because why not? There's something else that came to mind. Oh yeah, so the other thing that's, I guess, important to say with protein intake is in that study we did with Dutch elite athletes from a wide variety of sports, you saw a very strong correlation between caloric intake and protein intake, which means that, for example, the endurance athletes who are like not the gym bros that love protein and are like, we're going to take whey protein after exercise, which none of them did. They all, well, on average, they consumed 1.5 grams per kilogram per day, which you wouldn't necessarily associate with them based on their behavior, but they just trained more, burned more calories, consumed more calories, and as a result had a higher protein intake. The flip side is, of course, in sports where there is an emphasis on weight, like gymnastics or maybe fitness girls competing, they are more at risk of lower protein intake. So it's just good for people to just be aware that some, I know that some people, they only count their protein intake in their protein foods. So they think like, okay, my protein shakes count and my meat sources count, and I'm not going to count in the other foods, but you'll see that all the other foods, at least when you're not cutting, add up to quite a bit of protein. Maybe now one more thing, since I'm ranting anyway. In that same study about the elite Dutch athletes, we saw that, I don't know the exact number, it was pretty close to 50-50, that 50% of protein intake is from plant-based sources, which was higher than I always thought. I thought like, especially in athletes, they know protein intake is important, so they probably get most from meat and dairy, etc. But it shows that, yeah, in most people, plant-based protein has quite a substantial contribution to protein intake. So obviously there's a lot of discussions like, are plants worse? Can vegans even build muscle mass? Even if you're an omnivore, you probably don't want to root against plant-based protein, because it's likely that if you haven't counted that, and unless you are actually supplementing with, say, whey protein, that plant-based protein is a substantial part of your protein intake, so you want it to be at least decent.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there actually. I've not really thought about the underreporting and like the self-reporting of protein and how that could play into the outcomes there, and then also the average person size and the outcomes that are coming in there. So it makes a lot of sense what you're saying, where hey, maybe if you really want to make sure, have a bit more protein because of the underreporting, and then also for larger or smaller individuals, kind of having those considerations, which I think is super interesting. And actually, this is a question that often comes up is, should you just count like pure protein sources and discount like the protein you're getting in like a bagel? Maybe there's 10 grams in there and then you have some pasta. Is that, should you discount that, or should you, how much should someone take that into consideration, do you think? Is there a certain percentage of your protein that should come from high quality sources? And if there's like, I don't know, 80-20, you're cool. But if it's like 60-40, you might want to think about upping your protein even more.
Yeah, so that, again, like everything comes down to your total protein intake. The higher your total protein intake, the less protein quality matters. Because even if you have a crappy protein that's not fully digestible, has a very unbalanced essential amino acid composition, as long as you eat enough of it, it will provide everything you need. But in practice, people like that issue, for example, with an unbalanced essential amino acid composition, you see that in studies, but most people don't eat peas for breakfast and then corn for lunch. So they're mixing different sources together. And maybe the corn, for example, corn is actually very high in leucine, which a lot of other plants are low in. And by blending them all together, you get a much more balanced amino acid composition than any of them separate. So unless you're eating single source meals throughout the day, which basically no one does, protein quality from an amino acid composition point of view is not that big of a deal. Then the other big determinant of protein quality is how digestible protein is, because if you don't digest it, you simply never use it. You poop it out. In the Western world, that is not a big issue. Most foods we eat are highly digestible. You see in third world countries where protein intake is very low, and then usually it's very fibrous whole foods. Fiber is amazing, but it does inhibit protein absorption. In the Western world, I'm more concerned with people getting enough protein than, oh no, it hurts their protein. So the answer is yes, they should count it. Unless they have a very, very weird and extreme diet, they can pretty much count it. And again, I recommend usually people, if you have only a slight worry, just eat a little bit more in general, and then you're all good. So yeah, just count it, and whatever, if you use MyFitnessPal, it will count it anyway for you. So it's not like it's more work to take it into account. So just count it. And unless you're a complete vegan, there I would say, okay, maybe everything is like suboptimal protein, maybe build a little bit of a bigger safety margin. But for 95% of people, it just counts as 1 gram of protein if you have 1 gram of protein from a bagel.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think that actually nicely covered kind of how much protein totally to have. Distribution, we'd already essentially gone over where, I mean, anywhere. Three is a good minimum for someone trying to, not minimum, three is like the probably the sweet spot for maximizing muscle growth. If you go above that, it's no better. If you go below that, maybe there's something lost, but probably very marginal. We don't really know at this point. And then in terms of like quality proteins, if they're lower, have a bit more. But otherwise, if you're having an omnivorous diet even, you're probably just fine. You can count everything in there. Is that fair?
Yeah. Again, it comes back down to that we're joking that we put ourselves out of business. Like, as long as you have enough protein, all the details will take care of themselves, at least in the sports world. And some other worlds, like clinical nutrition, it's a little bit more difficult. But for an athlete, as much as I love protein, just eat enough and you're good.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Jean. This has been a fantastic discussion. I've really enjoyed it. If people want to keep up with your lab, your work, I know you do. Well, actually, it's been a while since you posted on Instagram, I think, but you have a really great Instagram, which I'd encourage people to go visit it and look through the other posts. And I'm sure you're about to post something soon. I'll have something in the pipeline. And you also have an amazing website as well, which I often visit for things like the muscle protein synthesis research. I know you have a whole page on that, which I've kind of read multiple times. So yeah, where should people head now? I've teased them.
So they can find me at most places. So my website as well as socials on Nutrition Tactics. The only exception is Twitter, which is my name, which I won't pronounce. Maybe it's somewhere on the page if you're still on the page here. Otherwise, just look for Nutrition Tactics and you'll find me. And I'll try to get going again on social media, but I'll quickly give the backstory for the listeners. Once I got enough funds to do this study, I needed to finish the study because the research materials were expiring. So I was like, okay, this is the only thing that matters in life. So that was one reason why I was distracted. Then once I did this study, like I said, I'm pretty convinced of the hypothesis. And I was like, I don't want to go on podcast and say the current evidence-based 20 grams per meal. I don't think it's true. So I was like, well, just wait till we got the results and then I'll share things again. And that kind of got out of hand. And I stopped posting about other stuff as well. But now I'm back. So back on producing some content about protein and other stuff.
Fantastic.
Believe it or not, we also do other stuff than protein.
Yeah, fantastic. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff on there. If people are interested in this discussion, they'll love your Instagram as well. I'll make sure that's all linked in the description so people can find those out. Again, thank you, John, and thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you soon.
Thanks, Steve.
Losing weight fast while maintaining muscle mass. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? It isn't though, it's reality and we know how to do it and we will help you achieve this. The Minicut Movement is an 8-week fat loss program to make you lose a huge chunk of fat while maintaining muscle mass at the same time. We will support you from the beginning to the end so that you see the results you would like to and come out of it much stronger. You'll receive a fully automated spreadsheet that is based on your nutritional needs. You can choose between 6 different male and female training templates. Over 30 videos will guide you through each and every single step of the Minicut so that you're getting the most out of your journey and that you always know what to do. But the best thing is that you can start whenever you want. The Minicut Movement is open 24/7. So if you want to learn more or you're ready to sign up, hit the link in the description below. So let's revive stronger together.